In this fifth talk, Dr. Martos discusses some of the changes that have taken place in our thinking about the sacraments and in our sacramental practices since the early 1960s. Changes in the rites and in the liturgy have brought about changes in our sacramental experience, changes in our experience of worship, and changes in the way we think about worship. Moreover, Dr. Martos argues, because of the variety that is now allowed in sacramental practice, both around the United States and around the world, Catholics in the future will have to become accustomed to having not one, but a variety of sacramental theologies.
One of the main themes of this set of lectures is that sacramental practice and sacramental theology mutually influence one another, or that Christian worship and the Church's attempt to understand its worship continually interact, so that we can say that what Christians did in their religious rituals had an impact on what they thought they were doing. And what they thought they were doing, that is to say, their theologizing about what they were doing, had an impact on what they did and how they did it. As we have seen in the previous lecture, however, from roughly the middle of the 16th century to roughly the middle of the 20th century, the official Catholic rituals did not change very much. The original reason for this sacramental stability was the concern of Catholic leaders to preserve the Church's worship from the laxity that led to the kinds of abuses that brought about the Protestant reaction and the need for a general liturgical house cleaning in the Church. One of the social and cultural factors which enabled that 16th century liturgical reform to last for such a long time, however, four centuries, was that the Catholic Church as a social institution remained fairly isolated from the social changes that began to take place mainly in Protestant Europe and America from the 17th to the 20th centuries. Political changes such as the overthrow of European monarchies and the introduction of democracy, economic changes such as the Industrial Revolution and the growth of commerce, social changes such as the rise of an educated and powerful middle class, intellectual changes such as the development of modern science and the appearance of new philosophies. The so-called Catholic countries during this period, Spain, Portugal, and their Latin American colonies, Italy, Poland, and France up till the time of the French Revolution, remained largely rural and agricultural. They were non-democratic monarchies, and they were not great centers for science and other intellectual innovations. Even the Catholics who migrated to America, with few exceptions, stayed together in German, Irish, Italian, and other ethnic communities, which preserved their social and religious identity and allowed them to continue their old traditions without much change. Gradually, however, this situation began to be altered, and by the 20th century, Catholics in both Europe and America were beginning to be forced out of their social and economic, political, and intellectual isolation. And as they did this, they began to question some of the long-established Catholic ways of doing things and thinking about things. To say it briefly, once Catholicism as a widespread religious community began to enter into the changes of the modern world, it once again sensed the need for change in both its liturgical worship and the way it understood its liturgical worship. We can point to specific developments, usually spearheaded by Catholic intellectuals, such as the liturgical movement, the scriptural renewal, the revival of medieval philosophy, or neo-scholasticism as it was called, but the overall picture was the reintroduction of change into the liturgical and theological life of the Church. And when historical studies in the 20th century showed that for 16 out of the Church's 20 centuries, change had been a normal part of the Church's life, there didn't seem to be any excuse for not allowing this natural process of religious evolution to once again become part of Catholicism. Pope John XXIII recognized this when, in 1959, he called for an ecumenical council of the world's Catholic bishops, the first in almost 100 years. And the agenda for that council was summed up in one word of the Pope, aggiornamento, an Italian word meaning updating. That Second Vatican Council called for changes in the Church's sacramental worship and set up liturgical commissions to draw up new rites, which were gradually introduced between the mid-1960s and the mid-1970s. The results of those changes are well known to all of us, since we are now living with them in our parishes and other Christian communities. And because those changes have come about, our experience of liturgical and sacramental worship has been altered. But this compels us to ask new questions about the meaning and value of what we are doing, and this in turn leads us to come up with answers that make sense and shed light on our contemporary experience of the Mass and the sacraments. Depending on how old you are, you may or may not be aware of the changes in sacramental practices that have occurred during the past 20 years. That is, you may not be old enough to remember what the Latin Mass and the Tridentine sacraments were like. But even if you are old enough to notice the external changes, you may not have taken the time to examine some of the internal changes, or changes in the experience of ritual worship, that have occurred in you and other Catholics during this same time period. It is important to do this, however, because it is our full experience, both external and internal, of sacramental worship, which leads us to wonder about the meaning and reality of what we are doing. And it is within that same unified experience of worship that we check out proposed answers to those questions and ultimately accept some as being true in the light of that prayer experience and discard others as being nice theories, perhaps, but not being very accurate or valid or helpful. How then has the complex experience of Catholic worship, both external and internal, both individual and communal, changed as a result of the now not so recent revisions of the rites? Without exhausting the subject, I think we can safely say that it has changed from being primarily an experience of individual worship to being an experience of communal worship, and that it has changed from being primarily an attitude of passive worship to being an attitude of active worship. With few exceptions, prayer and worship in the Latin liturgy that dated from the Council of Trent were largely private affairs. Sure, they were done to some extent in public, that is to say, going to Mass, attending a baptism, receiving confirmation, and so on. But in the sacramental moment itself, the focus was on the individual and the individual's relation to God. So, in the Mass, we were encouraged to focus our attention on the altar and not be distracted by the other people in the church and what they were doing. At a baptism, we had a sense that what was really happening was a change in the soul of an individual baby being baptized. And the same thing could be said of confirmation, marriage, or the other sacraments in which people were said to receive something from God. And, of course, penance and extreme unction, as the anointing of the sick was then called, were very private and personal affairs. There was no such thing as a public penance service or a communal anointing. So, by and large, our experience of sacramental worship before the Second Vatican Council was very private and individual. What was emphasized was our personal relationship to God, and our experiences of the sacred, when they occurred, tended to be somewhat mystical. That is, they tended to be the kinds of experience that the saints and the mystics in the church say they had when they experienced the personal presence of God, which is to say, they experienced themselves as human individuals in the presence of a divine individual, so to speak. Today, however, our experience of liturgical and sacramental worship is much different. For various reasons that we shall see later on in these lectures, the rites for the Mass and the other sacraments have been rewritten so that they are group rather than individual activities. Their prayers talk about communal rather than private worship, and in both action and word we are encouraged to interact with the people around us and to think about the larger parish, the Catholic Church, and the world community in which we find ourselves. As a result, our experience of the sacred tends to be much more diffuse or spread around the group with whom we are worshiping, and it tends to permeate the whole sacramental ritual rather than being focused on a single moment, such as the consecration of the host at Mass or the pouring of water at baptism. And this kind of experience is found not only at Sunday Mass, but even in the other sacramental rituals, which quite often, although not always, are communal celebrations which cause us to be aware of one another. You could say that our experience of God, too, has shifted from being a mystical one to being an interpersonal one. That is, instead of having sometimes intense experiences of being a human individual in the presence of a divine individual, the experience is often more like being one member of a group which is somehow filled with God's presence. So both our awareness of that presence and our experience of it are somehow tied up with the interpersonal situation of communal worship in which we find ourselves. Besides changing from an experience of individual worship to an experience of communal worship, our attitude in the revised sacramental rituals has also changed from being passive to being more active. This is not to say that before the Second Vatican Council, Catholics were supposed to do absolutely nothing at Mass or nothing at any of the other sacraments, but the main thing that we were encouraged to do was to open ourselves up, so to speak, to be receptive of God's grace. So the basic interior attitude that we were encouraged to take was one of passivity and receptivity. Over and above this, however, there was a popular conception that the sacraments could do whatever they were supposed to do without too much active effort on our part. We talked about receiving a sacrament, and we had the understanding that we would receive the sacrament's spiritual effects just by being there, as it were, and just by being willing and open to receiving those effects. We talked about going to Mass or attending Mass in the same way that we talk about going to a movie or attending the opera. Psychologically and spiritually, we might be drawn into it, but the Mass or the baptism could go on without us, for example, just as a movie or an opera can go on without us. And this experiential attitude of being present at a religious ritual without necessarily being a part of it or contributing to it made it possible to think and speak of the sacraments as being always effective. It was God who was operating in and through the sacraments, and of course, whenever God does something, it happens. What has happened in the last 20 years, however, is that the rituals have been revised in such a way that they call for and demand our active involvement. Theological writers talk less about receiving the sacraments and more about celebrating the sacraments. And they don't talk so much anymore about attending Mass as they do about participating in the liturgy. Now we have prayers to read and responses to say. We often have songs to sing and actions to perform, such as marching in procession, greeting the people around us, and so forth. And when we do this, a very peculiar thing starts to happen way deep down inside our spiritual guts. It's like when you smile at a person that you really hate, or even worse, when you have to shake their hand. Somehow you're aware that the outer reality doesn't match your inner reality, and you feel like a hypocrite. What happens as we begin to take an active part in sacramental worship is that we begin to sense that either we should change our inner attitudes so that they match our outer actions and words, or maybe if we don't really want to change inside, what we should do is stop pretending to be something that we are not. And so, in all honesty, what we should do is find something else to do on Sunday morning or whenever else we usually attend sacramental worship. Although there are many reasons why Catholics have stopped going to confession regularly, I suspect that this here is one of them. Namely, that people began to realize that very often they didn't feel sorry for the infractions of the law that were often called sins, like missing Sunday Mass or practicing birth control, and they did feel guilty about things that they could not tell in confession, like being a member of a rich society surrounded by global poverty, or like supporting a government that backs dictatorships around the world. In the old days, if children said that they didn't get much out of the Mass, it really didn't matter. The sacrament could be what it was, and it could do what it did, even without your getting anything out of it. Today, however, we have experienced the difference between effective liturgies and ineffective liturgies. Sometimes we've been intensely affected by a ritual that we have participated in, and we sense, sometimes almost subconsciously, that if we as Catholics talk about the sacraments as being effective rituals, then they really ought to have some effect on us, both here during the sacramental celebration and afterwards in the way that we feel and think and behave. And so we become restless and dissatisfied when liturgies repeatedly fail to affect us, repeatedly fail to affect our minds and hearts and our lives, when they don't speak to us or move us in some way. Granted, the fault, if one wishes to look at it that way, may be as much ours as anyone else's. And perhaps before we blame the priest or parish, we ought to look within our own hearts and ask what is holding us back from entering more completely into the rhythm and reality of public worship. But no matter what the cause, the result is that today, when sacramental liturgies are experienced to be ineffective, we are both more aware and more critical of that than most of our parents and grandparents were. The change, then, from passive attendance to active participation in the very design of our sacramental rituals has begun to change the way we think and feel and even talk about them. But it cannot be said that this change in words and attitudes about the sacraments is entirely the result of recent changes in the sacramental rituals and the way that we experience them. As a matter of fact, most of those changes would never have come about if, in the years before the Second Vatican Council, there had not been liturgists and theologians who were already beginning to think and speak differently about the liturgy, and who were already suggesting that the Latin Mass and the Tridentine sacraments did not really take into account the variety of forms the sacraments had enjoyed throughout history, the variety of people who were supposed to take part in them, and the variety of ways that they could be understood and explained. Now, if the big difference in sacramental practice since the Second Vatican Council is change, the big difference in sacramental theology since the Council is variety. If you look at Catholic theological textbooks written in the early 1900s and as late as the 1950s, they all contain a fairly uniform scholastic theology of the sacraments. That is, the philosophical theory that was used to explain the sacraments, or the intellectual framework within which the sacraments were understood, was always that of medieval scholasticism. The same historical investigations which showed that before the Middle Ages, the sacraments did not always have a definite liturgical form, those same investigations showed that before the Middle Ages, the sacraments had been understood within other intellectual frameworks, and that they had been explained with the help of other philosophical theories. Before the Middle Ages, and even up through the early Middle Ages, the sacraments had been primarily understood not as causes of grace, but as signs of grace. That is, not in terms of causality, but in terms of their signification and significance in the life of the Church. And so, in the 1950s, Catholic theologians began to speak of the sacraments primarily as signs or symbols. They insisted that they did not want to deny the causality of the sacraments, and that they only wanted to restore the balance between the causal and symbolic aspects of the sacraments. Even the most traditional definition of the sacraments had called them signs of grace. But this new emphasis on the symbolic nature of the sacramental rituals, combined with scriptural studies which were going on at the same time, recovering and re-explaining the richness of the biblical symbolism of water, oil, bread, wine, and other more abstract images, led Catholic theologians to begin to question the sacramental minimalism that they had taken for granted, and led Catholic liturgists to suggest that sacramental rituals ought to be richly rather than minimally symbolic. Using real bread for the Eucharist, for example, if the sacraments were to be truly effective in the lives of Christians. During the same period, moreover, two European theologians, Edward Skillebex in the Netherlands and Karl Rahner in Germany, were developing a theology of the sacraments which was quite different from the scholastic theology of the sacraments, but which did not contradict the older theology. Their new approach to the sacraments was based on ideas developed by 20th century philosophers rather than on ideas developed by ancient and medieval philosophers, and it began with a rather sophisticated analysis of the nature and function of symbols. Most of us take for granted, for example, that what we see when we open our eyes is reality itself. Actually, however, it is not that simple. Let's, however, give a simple example of what these philosophers are talking about. And let's say I go to Hollywood, and I go to visit a movie set where they're making a Western, and I see at one end of this old Western town a small square building, bars on the windows and a heavy wooden door, and a sign on the wall that says J-A-I-L. Now, I've always wanted to see what an old Western jail looks like, and so I go over and open the door. But instead, the handle comes off in my hand. It's made out of plastic. And when I go to look inside the windows, I notice that the bars are made of rubber hose, and that inside the building, there's nothing, absolutely nothing. It's just an empty shell, painted and fixed up to look like a stone and steel jail. Well, there are various ways that this experience could be analyzed, but some contemporary philosophers called phenomenologists, because they are concerned with phenomena or the way things appear to us, these philosophers might say that the outward appearances of this building symbolized a certain inner reality. But in this case, the symbolism was false, because the inner reality did not in fact correspond to the outward appearances. Normally, however, just the opposite is true. The outward appearances of things do correspond to their inner reality. And this is why, although in fact we see only the outward appearances of things, we think we directly see their inner reality. As a matter of fact, however, we can make a distinction for anything that exists between its outward appearance and its inner reality, and we can say that its appearance symbolizes its reality, so that we come to know what it is and interact with it through those elements of its reality which for us symbolize what it is, what it does, what it can be used for, and so on. People are like that too, of course. We get to know people, we get to know what they're like, we become familiar with their character and personality, to relate to them and to interact with them, largely through the signals or signs that they give us, which reveal to us who they are and what they're like. But now, we can also reverse this analysis. Not only do we get to know others through the words and gestures and clothing and the decisions and lifestyles which symbolize what they are, but the reverse is also true. We express who and what we really are in and through the words we say, the gestures we make, the clothes we wear, through our decisions and choices, and in general, through our whole lifestyle. In a sense, then, this is true of everything that exists, whether it's a rock, or a tree, or an animal, or a person. By appearing the way it appears, and by doing what it does, it is symbolically expressing what it is. And this is why, when others come along who can read the symbols, they can get to know realities through their symbolic expression. Going even further, we can observe that all communication between persons is based on symbolism. The most obvious example of this is words. Words are written or spoken symbols that we use to communicate with one another. Not so obvious, but equally important, are the nonverbal ways in which we symbolize what we are to others, and through which they symbolize what they are to us. And when we stop to analyze it, as in fact psychologists and sociologists have done, most of our communication takes place in and through nonverbal rather than verbal symbols. If we think now of God's communication to us, we suddenly realize that the same is true. Until we stop and reflect about it, we think of revelation as words, for example, the words in the Bible, or the words that God spoke to Moses, or the words of Jesus in the Gospels. But as a matter of fact, the words in the Bible got written down usually sometime after a given revelation had taken place. The Israelites saw God revealing himself to them in the events of their history, in the migration of Abraham, in the escape of his descendants from Egypt, in their conquest of the Promised Land, and so on, long before the meaning of those events was interpreted for them by their religious leaders, and long before the stories recounting those events were written into the Hebrew Scriptures. And it's the same way with the New Testament. Christians believe that Jesus himself, not just his words, is God's ultimate and most complete revelation. So much so that we speak of Jesus as the Word of God spoken in history. In this sense, then, it is legitimate to say that the events of salvation history symbolized who and what God is for the Jews and for us too. And it is equally legitimate to say that Jesus is a symbol of God, the incarnate and living symbol of the Father's love and concern for all of us, as well as the incarnate and living symbol of what we are called to be as children of God, of how we are supposed to behave towards our fellow human beings. In other words, Jesus was and is, in a very real sense, a sacrament of God. For a sacrament is a sacred sign or a symbol of a sacred reality. In a similar sense, the church, which is the community of Jesus' followers, reveals or signifies or symbolizes to people today who Jesus is and what God is. In other words, the church too is a sacrament or a sacred sign, for it reveals and communicates the reality of God and the reality of Christ to people. But when, we can ask, does the church do this? In a general way, the church is a sacrament all the time, just by being what it is, a community of those who believe that Jesus is the Christ and who live according to his teachings, and a social institution which symbolizes the reality of God and the message of Jesus to the world. In a more specific way, however, the church is a sacrament when it, that is to say, the people in it, do the kinds of things that symbolically express the heart of the Christian message, the inner core of what it means to be a Christian and to be a church. Certainly, we can point to certain types of actions, such as caring for the sick and the needy, speaking out on behalf of the poor and the oppressed, preaching the gospel and sending out missionaries, as symbolic of the church's inner nature. Traditionally, however, it has been certain liturgical symbols or ecclesiastical rituals which have been designated as sacraments, and upon reflection, we see that these too are symbolic expressions of the church's nature, and which are at the same time symbolic revelations of the reality of Christ and symbolic communications of God's grace. Baptism, for example, ritually symbolizes a person's entry into the church and at the same time makes available to that person faith in Christ, the hope of salvation, and the love of God, which come to him or her by being a member of a loving and caring faith community. Penance both symbolizes and reactualizes in a person's experience, the medieval theologians would have said it causes, God's forgiveness for sins and failings which that person has become aware of and is sorry for after having been baptized. The Eucharist symbolizes and makes Christ's presence real to us in the context of the liturgy when we are gathered together for prayer and worship. Matrimony both symbolizes and really joins two Christians together in a life that is as close as the union of Christ and the Church. The same sorts of things could be said for the other sacraments. Karl Rahner, looking at the sacraments more from the viewpoint of the Church, calls them symbolic expressions of the Church's nature, for they express in a symbolic form what the Church is as the continuation of Christ's presence in history and the manifestation of God's grace in the world. Edward Skillebeck, looking at the sacraments more from the viewpoint of the people who participate in them, calls them encounters with Christ, for in them we come in contact with the risen Lord, and through him with the grace and power of God the Father. But the main advance that the approaches of Rahner and Skillebeck brought to sacramental theology was that they demonstrated that it was in fact possible to use a different philosophical system other than scholastic philosophy to understand and explain the sacraments and still remain faithful to the basic Catholic teachings on the sacraments. Once this happened, the door was opened to understanding the sacraments within other philosophical frameworks as well, and it wasn't long before theologians and religious educators, in their concern to explain the sacraments to others, began to borrow ideas and theories from secular disciplines such as psychology and sociology, and then used these theories to explain what the sacraments were and how they worked. In my book, Doors to the Sacred, I allude to those who in the 1960s developed a rather humanistic interpretation of the sacraments that was sort of in line with Rahner's insight that reality is not neatly divided into a natural realm on the one hand and a supernatural realm on the other. Rather, reality is a continuum, and so not only is there always a natural side to every supernatural reality, but there is also a supernatural side to every natural reality. This means, according to these interpreters of the sacraments, that we can focus on their human aspects, especially the human values and meanings that they celebrate, for we know that every natural reality has a supernatural dimension. Bernard Cook has also used the insight of sociology that the meaning we give to things is a part of their reality for us, and taking this as one of his key ideas, he has developed a sacramental theology which looks at sacramental celebrations as a time and a way that the meaning of life or basic attitudes towards life get transformed from what they would be without Christ and without the Christian community to what they can and should be because of Jesus' life, death, and resurrection, and because of the Church of which we are members. Since writing that book, I've noticed that many of the newer books on the subjects are bringing an even greater variety of viewpoints to bear on the sacraments, so that the sacraments do indeed look different when seen from different angles. In the future, then, I expect that we'll be much more at home in looking at the sacraments now from the perspective of process thinking, now from the perspective of liberation theology, now from the perspective of linguistic philosophy, now from the perspective of comparative religions. And also, we'll be more at home with looking at the sacraments now from a North American perspective, now from a Latin American perspective, now from a European perspective, now from an Asian or African perspective, and so on. In other words, the days of uniformity in sacramental theology are over, which means that in the future, it'll be both harder and easier to do sacramental theology. It'll be harder because we'll no longer be able to appeal to St. Thomas or the Council of Trent or Karl Rahner and expect to come to a quick and easy consensus on a given issue. But on the other hand, our thinking about the sacraments will be easier because it'll have to be our own thinking about the sacraments, and in that sense, it'll have to be more honest, and we'll have to take responsibility for what we say rather than shift the burden of proof to some theological authority. Initially, that can be more difficult, and it can even be a little frightening if we haven't done it much before. But once we remember that the very best theologians, from St. Paul to St. Augustine to St. Thomas to those in our own present day, have always worked inductively from their own experience of prayer and worship to their conclusions about prayer and worship, then we realize that this method of operation is entirely natural and in some ways is even better than the method of citing the conclusions of others and then trying to figure out how they got there. It's better because even though we may not get as far in our thinking as professional theologians might, still every step we take is completely our own, and so we're forced to be much more careful and cautious in what we say about the sacraments. Suddenly, it becomes not so easy to make quick generalizations such as God forgives sins in the sacrament of penance. And we become much more at home with statements such as, when I go to confession, this is the way I experience it, or this is the way it happens for me, or this is what I find works and doesn't work. It's a way of doing theology that is much more individualized and down to earth. But often, it's also much more honest, and in that sense, it's much truer.